subject that I was intending to talk about today, but I'm going to do it in a somewhat different order, but we'll see when we get there. The Bozer transition. I'm on slide 13 of lecture of part 6. It actually looks somewhat different from slide 13 of part 6, since I changed a plus 1 to a minus 1 to agree with physics. Okay, what are we doing? We're summing to describe what goes on in a three-dimensional system of bosons. We sum over a bunch of integers, m, which is mx, my, mz. That's equivalent to, if the integers are very closely spaced together, to doing an integral dp over 2 pi h bar cubed times L cubed. However, sometimes we can't get away with doing such a sum. In particular, the case where we can't get away with replacing the sum by an integration is one in which we have a Bose system which is condensed. So a finite fraction of the entire system is in a single quantum mode. That mode is usually the m equals 0 mode, although it needn't be. It can be other modes of the system are available for condensation. The probability for the average number of particles in a mode is the energy of the mode minus mu, exponential of that, minus 1. This minus sign has an important consequence. It means that this fraction can become arbitrarily large if it happens that epsilon takes on its minimum value, which in this case is 0, and if mu takes on a value which is just a tiny bit negative. We can't have mu being positive because that will mean a negative value of this fraction, and this fraction is the is physically the number of particles, average number of particles in the mode described by M. And what we're doing is we're summing to get the total number of particles. To get a more physical view of the thing, we divide by the size of the box. So instead of calculating the total number of particles, we calculate the number of particles by per unit volume. And that's something that we call small n in our various things. And in fact, what we do is, L does not, yes, it does. No, it does not belong. In fact, what we do is convert this sum into an integral, and we have an integral over momentum, 2 pi h bar cubed, of this occupation number. However, we can't quite get away with that. The m equals 0 term is special and comes out specially large. Mu is very small, beta mu is very small, and we get a contribution 1 over L cubed times beta mu. This contribution, because beta mu is of order 1 over the size of the system cubed, this contribution is as big as this contribution. Now, this is a three-dimensional integral, if we're playing with a three-dimensional system. It converges. dp means, dp with a vector sign, means p squared dp times a integral over angles. And that p squared and this p squared work together to make the integral convergent even when p goes to 0. So this term is just a function of temperature and is not particularly special. This term is special because it is a very large number of particles in the lowest mode and is a delicate function of the value of the chemical potential. The integration has a result that goes to 0 as t cubed goes to 0 as t cubed as the temperature goes to 0. That means at the lowest temperature, this term will dominate. This term is necessary in order to maintain a non-zero density as the temperature goes to 0. And this term, as I said, represents a bunch of particles condensed into the very lowest mode of the system. This state might be, as I have stated it, the state in which has a momentum equal to 0. However, other things are possible. For example, in a geometry like this, it is possible for a condensation to occur into a state with angular momentum different from 0 and for a current to keep on going around. The current will go around essentially forever. Even if the particles bump into something, the particles will then unbump into it. That is, the particles will then return to this special state because, in fact, the Boltzmann equation that we have means that there is an especially large amount of scattering into the state in which there are a huge number of particles. This, then, is a supercurrent, in this case of a donut-shaped container. That current can continue essentially indefinitely. Please.
Should we have this part 6 in our notes?
This is not, yes. Okay, let me go back and tell you the history of the world. The history of the world was that I wasn't going to include this in the, however, the tutors asked me to include it. I have asked the tutors to add it as part 6 of the notes, but you probably can find it on the computer. It is probably not in your printed version.
It's not online.
Not online. Well, it'll get there. My apologies first of all, for changing, and secondly, for not having the usual amenities available to you all. I will try to talk particularly clearly. I wonder whether last year's notes are available to you. Certainly up last year. I don't know whether last year's notes were available to you. In any case, when all of the excitement from our sick colleague dies down, you might ask Dennis what's going on and get him to put it up in the notes. Okay, there is an H theorem for bosons. That H theorem, as you recall, for particles which were not degenerate, involved an integral dp of f of p times a logarithm of f of p. This gives minus the entropy. With a minus sign, this integral, when appropriately done, with a 2 pi h bar cubed, and a integral over space gives the entropy of the system. A similar theorem can be derived from the Boltzmann equation that you have for bosons. The Boltzmann equation for bosons, no, backwards. Nope, I'll find it. It's the problem of doing things that you weren't intending to do. Everything is sort of out of order. Let's go backward one. Here's the Boltzmann equation for bosons. The Boltzmann equation for bosons has these extra factors of 1 plus F in the final states of the scattering, saying, as I said last time and I'm saying again now for the third time, that you tend, when these, when the final states are heavily occupied, you tend to get more scattering into the states. That's what these, this 1 plus F factor represents. That 1 plus F factor changes the result that one gets for the entropy, and the entropy becomes an integral of that quantity for bosons. That takes care of bosons for us fairly well. And we can go on to talk about fermions. Landau described fermions at low temperatures by saying that they had a free energy which depended on F of P, R, and T, the occupations of the fermion modes, with momentum in the neighborhood of P and position in the neighborhood of R at time T. He said that as the occupation number of these fermions changed, the free energy changed by an amount delta F, which is the integral of dpdr over h cubed, times some energy which depends on P, R, and T. This is an energy of an excitation with momentum P, and then the change in the occupation numbers. What he was doing when he did that was said that the standard statistical mechanics that we've talked about all along is extended to represent this low-temperature fermion system. And the major change is in that extension is that you get what are called quasi-particle excitations, excitations which are not just simply particles, but particles moving around in the sea produced by all of the other particles in the system. Those quasi-particles have an energy which is not just p squared over 2m, but an extra energy given by all of the other particles in the system. Many of you know something about quasi-particles because in your previous courses you've taken something about solid-state physics and seen block waves, which are electrons in a periodic potential produced inside of a solid. They also have a quasi-particle energy, which depends on momentum, in that case, however, not upon R and T. The usual, what Landau said, it was sort of confusing. I read the paper sort of when it first came out, and Landau basically said, let's do that. Let's use the usual Poisson brackets talk about how one derives a Boltzmann equation. And so his Boltzmann equation is the time derivative of F plus the gradient in momentum space of the energy times the gradient of, in coordinate space of F, the gradient in position space of the energy, the gradient in momentum of F. He simply assumed that classical mechanics or mechanics would extend directly to giving this thing for a low-temperature system of helium-3, in which the interactions between the particles were important. You may recall that last time I was saying that physicists often don't actually derive things. They sort of assume them and then see whether they work. Landau had pretty much no reason for assuming this, except that it was a natural extension of what people might want to do with block waves in condensed matter physics, a natural extension of ordinary statistical mechanics. And he basically assumed that. That assumption has turned out to be correct. People since then have shown that this approach is right, at least for many low-temperature systems of fermions. The full Boltzmann equation, including the collision term, has in it the structures you might expect. It has in it, as we mentioned before, an integral over particles that you're scattering against, over final states, over states that you scatter into, represented by P prime and Q prime. You recall that the scattering process was one in which our particle, the particle we're watching, comes in with momentum P, finds another particle with momentum Q, and they go out with momentum P prime and Q prime. Something happens in here. We don't detail very much what happens in here, except that the probability for such a scattering is denoted by the symbol R, and then you have, as part of that, a conservation of momentum, conservation of energy. Of course, the energy which is conserved is the quasi-particle energy, epsilon, not p squared over 2m, but the what you would call in particle physics the dressed energy of the particle, the energy that the particle gains by its interactions with all of the other particles in the system. Finally, you have scattering probabilities f of p, f of q. That's the probability that you'll find another particle to scatter against. And 1 minus f of p prime, 1 minus f of q prime. This is the statement that if the state with momentum p prime is occupied, you're not going to be able to scatter into it. The probability of finding it occupied is 1 minus f of p prime. The probability of finding the other state occupied is 1 minus f of q prime. And so you write a Boltzmann equation that looks like this. Here is the scattering in the opposite direction in which particles with momentum p prime and q prime come in and go out with momentum p and q. Yes, please.
I understand why you have to have the factors of 1 minus f in the formulas, but if we could go a little back, I just don't understand what is the reason for the 1 plus f in bosons.
Okay. You do understand. You just quantized the electromagnetic field, and that's not a good way of explaining it. Let me think for a moment. I told you the history. I'll tell you the history again, but that is not maybe a tremendous help. In classical electrodynamics, what you're talking about is the scattering of, so now we're back to Bose particles, and in particular we will start out with the scattering of photons. Of course, we understand photons as Bose particles better than other things. In electrodynamics, we have a process in which a photon comes in, photon, scatters off an electron, photon. It's called Compton scattering, and then the photon goes off. In fact, processes in which photons are not only scattered but are produced, a process in which there's a charged particle, and that charged particle tends to produce the charged particle is in motion, is accelerating, and that charged particle tends to produce a photon by its acceleration. Very well known, even in classical electrodynamics. That's how photons are produced. Trying to remember, I'm stop that. I'm trying to remember the proper answer to your question. Yes. So we're talking about processes in which there's a charged particle, E. That charged particle is moving up and back, and a photon is produced. According to Einstein's calculation, Einstein was the first to do the calculation right, there were two possibilities. One is if there were other photons around with that same momentum, that process with the existence of the other photons around with the same momentum tended to enhance the production of photons with that momentum. That process is called stimulated emission and is one of the two processes that is going on. The other process is that you, even if the other photon isn't around, you tend to get photons emitted in this process. When you look at the two together, you get 1 plus NP, 1 plus the number of photons with that momentum. And that was Einstein's basic major contribution to electrodynamics, to get that's the combination of this and this together, this 1 plus NP. The same thing happens then with any kind of Bose particle. You get 1 plus F. Now, how do I really know that we get 1 plus F? Well, Einstein's argument was the following. He knew from Planck and from statistical mechanics, CK, and StatMech, that the number of particles around with momentum P was going to be e to the minus beta h bar omega p minus 1. This is the energy of a photon with momentum P, and he knew that from what Planck said about electrodynamics. He knew it from studies of electrodynamics in cavities. He also knew it from the behavior of Bose particles. I showed you last time that if you did a sum from n equals 0 up to infinity of e to the minus beta h bar omega q times n, which is the appropriate Boltzmann factor, you get a geometric series, and the geometric series has 1 minus e to the beta h bar omega q. And that's this thing, just written backwards. Einstein then argued that in order to get this answer, he had to have a Boltzmann equation or some analog equation with a plus sign here. I will show you how that happens in a second, because I have a calculation that goes through it for fermions. I'm going to go through it for fermions and show how we get the fermion answer, and then I'll go through it for bosons and tell you how we get the boson answer. Since we already know the answer, that is a justification for the boson form of the Boltzmann equation. Let's do it for fermions. Fermions have a structure in the Boltzmann equation, which is F of P times 1 minus F of P prime times 1 minus F of P prime minus the same thing written backwards. I want to get out the result of that Maxwell-Boltzmann theory would give for for fermions for particles. Boltzmann theory would give for fermions for particles which can either have occupied or unoccupied states, in which n turns out to have the values either 0 or 1, but not anything else. That value we calculated as e to the minus beta epsilon p minus mu, 1 divided by that exponential plus 1. Now I want to derive that from the Boltzmann equation. Derivation. I take that thing inside of curly brackets. I divide through by all of the factors of 1 minus f. 1 minus f of p, 1 minus f of q, 1 minus f of p prime, 1 minus f of q prime. When I am done, that division cancels out. I should say, let me do an escape. I should say that I want this thing to be equal to 0. And so I'm going to divide through by all of the 1 minus f's, and I'm still going to have a result that I want to be equal to 0. That's the statement that there is no net scattering, that we have an equilibrium process. Now I ask you to recall the algebraic structure that we had before. Before, we didn't have any of these red factors, but for non-degenerate particles, we had only the black particles, the black factors. We put in the black factors that looked like this, and we saw that there was full cancellation because of the delta functions in the Boltzmann equation. Now it is a new thing which will produce the full cancellation. F divided by 1 minus f is the exponential, and that exponential will produce a full cancellation of this result. When I rewrite this in terms of f, I get out the result of the equilibrium distribution function that I knew should occur for fermions. If I went through the same argument for bosons, I would have a plus sign there, a plus sign there, plus sign there, plus sign there. This is the argument that Einstein went through. It would end up having a plus sign here, and that would end up producing a minus sign right there, that giving us the answer we know occurs for bosons. So a long answer to your question is that Einstein looked at the processes which produced the known distribution function for photons. He wrote down an analog of the Boltzmann equation for that and figured out what should go into the Boltzmann equation, which gave this known answer. Okay. We were on this slide. We naturally went to this slide. I explained how we derived this equilibrium answer for fermions from the Boltzmann equation. Next, go on to talk a little bit more about Landau's equation for low-temperature fermion systems. Here's the Boltzmann equation. We can do just about everything with this form of the Boltzmann equation that Boltzmann did with his more classical result for non-degenerate particles. For example, we can show that there's an H theorem in which the entropy is proportional to a sum of this thing, of this combination with a minus sign. This contribution to minus the entropy goes to 0 when F goes to either 0 or 1. Therefore, it is only the particles in states which are either not fully occupied or fully empty, which gives contribution to the entropy and the disorder in the system. We also can talk about the scattering rate that occurs in this system. The only important scattering processes are ones in which these f's are not precisely 0 or 1. If this f was equal to 1, of course, this would kill off the scattering here. If the f's were equal to 0, it would kill off the scattering here. The only important scattering processes that occur are ones in which the f's, in which the energies are within kT of the Fermi energy. That results in scattering rates which are proportional to T squared at low temperatures. And this low scattering rate guarantees that the quasiparticles, the excitations, are stable and, in fact, makes the whole theory right. We now come to the slide you asked about the dynamics of bosons, because I redid the discussion. The dynamics of bosons come again at here. And Einstein, in fact, figured out that the equation of motion for bosons, the analog of the Boltzmann equation for bosons, would have to have the factor 1 plus f in order to reach the result that was already known by Planck for the equilibrium distribution. That's what that says here. References to some of this stuff is, you can go back and read Daniel Kleppner in Physics Today about how Einstein did this. Einstein's original work is in translation in Terhaar's book. Louise Gilder, in a book which is probably out there, has some stuff about the derivation of quantum theory. I don't think it goes back quite as far as that. I'm going to stop now talking about fermions and bosons, and I'm going to start talking about phase transitions. Are there further questions about the fermions and bosons? Close this. I want to go on. Let's see if this is the right lecture. Yes. Okay. You have up in your notes in front of you my previous version of part 7 of the notes. As you can see, I'm going to talk about something which looks the same but has a different title. In fact, it's not the same at all. This is a talk that I gave at a seminar named after Dirac at Cambridge University, the part that's applied mathematics and theoretical physics. After looking it over, I decided that the Cambridge University version was better than the version in part 7. And I'm going to give the Cambridge University version and then stick in some stuff from part 7, which wasn't in the Cambridge University version. And I think I will do a better job all in all than I had in either version. Here is a picture of what we're talking about in phase transitions. This is an iceberg sitting in the ocean. We have in this picture at least three phases of water. There's the ocean, the liquid phase, the solid phase of ice, and the vapor phase up there in the atmosphere. It's there because it's a pretty picture, and I wanted a pretty picture at the front of this colloquium. This colloquium was in a series named after Paul Adrian Maurice Dirac. The subject of the colloquium is phase transition, scaling, universality, and renormalization. Or rather, that's wrong punctuation. Phase transitions, and I'll talk about scaling, universality, and renormalization. Dirac had invented renormalization in classical electrodynamics in a paper that he wrote in 1938. He also was very hostile to renormalization as it was used in particle physics later on. He said, "I might have thought that the new ideas, that is the new ideas in renormalization, the ideas brought forward by Schwinger and Tamanaga and Feynman, I might have thought that the new ideas were correct if they had not been so ugly." So Dirac was not a great believer in the second half of the 20th century theory of renormalization. I'm sort of a great believer in it, and I will talk about why I think it's a good theory. The talk has an abstract, which I will read to you. "In present-day physics, the renormalization method, as developed by Kenneth Wilson, serves as the primary method for constructing the connection between theories at different length scales." So I'm trying to tell the people in Cambridge, England, what renormalization is about. "This method is rooted in both particle physics and the theory of phase transitions." I'm talking about the sociology of where it came from. "It was developed to supplement mean field theories like those developed by van der Waals and Maxwell, followed by Landau." I'm going to be talking about history. "Sharp phase transitions are necessarily connected with singularities in statistical mechanics, which in turn require infinite systems for their realization." At this point in the abstract, I've told you what the essential point in this paper is going to be. I call this result the extended singularity theorem. A discussion of this point apparently marked a 1937 meeting in Amsterdam celebrating van der Waals. This sentence tells you that I'm not claiming to have invented the extended singularity theorem. however, I am claiming to have given it a name. "Mean field theories neither demand nor employ spatial infinities in their description of phase transitions. Another theory is required that weds a breaking of internal symmetries with a proper description of spatial infinities. The renormalization semi-group provides such a wedding. Its nature is described in this talk. The major ideas surrounding this point of view are described, including especially scaling universality and the development of connections among different theories." Something that you don't need to be told, however, something that audience needed to be told is a little bit about myself. I should remind you that I'm going to be talking partly about the philosophy of science and about particle physics, and I'm not an expert in either the philosophy of science or in particle physics. I'm going to be talking about both condensed matter physics and particle physics, and I want to tell you about what the grand goals are of both subjects. Condensed matter physics has a clear formulation. We start from things like statistical mechanics, a la Boltzmann, and the Schrödinger equation, well-defined theories. Our goal is to explain the amazing variety of nature. We see nature as sort of an onion in which we expose layer after layer, each piece of which has beautiful science in it and wonderful ideas. We hope to see mathematical and conceptual beauty arise from the mundane. Not every one of you people who do not know what the word mundane means. Mundane means worldly or everyday. Particle physics. Particle physics is really very simple. Experimentalists measure masses and cross sections, and things which are much less rich than the amazing variety of things measured in condensed matter physics. Particle physics seeks a clear and often a final theoretic formulation based upon experiment and observations. They hope to see the mundane, that is the simple worldly things, arise from the mathematical beauty of a single truth. Now about connections. Renormalization group, I'm claiming, provides connections among different kinds of theories. Condensed matter physics relates the observable, often macroscopic, that is, at our length scale, the length scale of a meter, properties of liquids, gases, solids, and all other everyday materials, to the more microscopic theories, often the quantum theory of atoms and molecules. Since the macroscopic theories are themselves non-trivial, for example, things like elasticity, hydrodynamics, the electrodynamics of materials, it follows that condensed matter physics is largely an exercise in connecting different kinds of theories, connecting microscopic theories with macroscopic theories. Typically, this connection involves different length scales, going from the size of a molecule, which is an angstrom, to the size of a laboratory, which is a few meters. One of the deepest aspects of condensed matter physics is the existence of different thermodynamic phases, each phase with qualitatively different properties from the other. For example, freezing is a sudden qualitative change in which the material gains rigidity. How can it happen that a system of molecules suddenly changes its qualitative properties? All thermodynamic behavior is based on statistical mechanics, so that we have to explain things like freezing on the basis of statistical mechanics. I'm also going to be talking about connections in particle physics. Particle physics often wishes to relate its present phenomenological theory to a deeper theory at a much shorter or longer length scale. That is, for example, it wants to connect the standard model of quantum chromodynamics to physics at the Large Hadron Collider scale, which is somewhat shorter than quantum chromodynamics, the physics at the unification scale, which is a factor of 10 to the 14 or so shorter than the scale of quantum chromodynamics, or to the Planck scale, which is shorter yet. Particle physics is looking for a final theory. Previously, the search for a final theory has been impeded by ugliness or singularities arising at scales far from observation. These singularities show up directly as infinities in perturbation theory and indirectly as algebraic behavior, 1 over distance to the power p, in a correlation function. I'm going to follow condensed matter physics for much of the talk, but particle physics and condensed matter physics are essentially similar. I should tell you something else about background. who here is from Cambridge? Anybody from Cambridge? Cambridge is a pretty snobby place. It's snobby in all kinds of different directions. And in particular, the condensed matter physicists are snobby towards the particle physicists, and the particle physicists are snobby towards the condensed matter physicists. They are in two different departments. No, Dennis is not from Cambridge either. I'm bad-mouthing Cambridge University. The two different groups hardly ever talk to one another. I worked at Cavendish Laboratory, which is the condensed matter part, for a year and a half, and essentially never met anyone from the particle physics part at Cambridge. Okay. If you might have heard in the words of these slides a slightly ironical tone. That's partly to do with this point of view. Field theory and statistical mechanics are closely connected. A Wick rotation, that is in time going into I over Boltzmann constant times temperature, will take you from field theory to statistical mechanics. Quantum theory, quantum mechanics, and classical mechanics are also closely connected. Both employ Hamiltonians as basic generators of time dependence, as do field theory and statistical mechanics. All four theories have a dual structure in which terms of the Hamiltonian both describe measurable quantities. A Hamiltonian might describe a kinetic energy, which is a measurable quantity. But the Hamiltonian equally well generates changes in time development. The word time seems to have been left out. All four have the same basic structure. I told you about this last time with Poisson brackets and commutators and conjugate variables, P's and Q's. I'll talk mostly about statistical mechanics. This is the lecture named after Dirac, or at least was in its original version. Dirac emphasized the connection among these four subjects: classical mechanics, quantum mechanics, statistical mechanics, etc. Statistical mechanics, defined by Ludwig Boltzmann in the 1870s, states that the probability for finding an equilibrium system in a volume element d gamma about a position gamma in phase space is equal to d gamma exponential of beta times the Hamiltonian minus the free energy. You know this. The free energy is given by an integral over all phase space. Thus, the free energy is proportional to a logarithm of a sum or integral of exponentials. I'm now going to tell you the essence of this talk, or the essence of today's and tomorrow's discussion. The essence is, for a system that is finite in extent, such a sum is always a smooth, mathematically a real analytic function of its arguments. That is, the free energy is a smooth function of temperature, of volume, chemical potential, and anything else that might appear here. We defined phase transition before as a discontinuous change in the qualitative behavior of the system as parameters like temperature or pressure are varied. The consequence of this definition, together with the statement that the free energy must be analytic in parameters for a finite system, is that phase transitions can only genuinely occur in infinite systems. That's what this says here. Here we have pictures, ice, water, rigid structures that are have crystal directions, no directions visible, something that sloshes around, absolutely a qualitative change, an abrupt change as the water solidifies. A phase transition appears as a sharp change in the form of thermodynamic functions as you go from one kind of behavior to another. These sharp changes are mathematical singularities. A singularity will not occur in any finite system as in a finite liquid. It's the third time I'm saying it, but it's the major point of the discussion I'm giving. The singularity can and does happen in an infinite system. A sum of a finite number of exponentials is analytic in parameters, and a sum of an infinite number of exponentials, you can't prove that it's analytic in its parameters. I give a name to this result. I call it the extended singularity theorem. People might argue that it isn't a theorem. It is a theorem. I've just told you how to prove it, and it is a result which you can prove mathematically, starting from Boltzmann's formulation of of statistical mechanics. This theorem has been extensively used, but is not really extensively discussed in the previous literature. It follows that any proper description of a phase transition requires a theory which makes explicit use of the infinite size of the system. Most theories constructed before Wilson's renormalization group of 1971 fail this test. Please.
Yes, singularity theorem, what is this, the singularity theorem?
Okay. Extended is an adjective describing the system rather than the singularity. You need an extended system to produce a singularity. I'm not sure that the words extended singularity theorem, just for the reason you just said, is the best description of the thing, but it's the description I thought up as I was trying to say what the thing was all about. Okay, something about the history. Phase transitions in the modern form were started, our understanding, was started in about 1870 when an Englishman by the name of Thomas Andrews experimentally studied the pressure volume temperature diagram of carbon dioxide. He first discovered the critical point. His data look roughly like, okay, I'll show you the data. This is something that most of you have seen as in your study of the van der Waals equation that many of you probably studied in grade school, others in college. Here we have a plot of pressure versus volume. Each of these lines is what the system does at fixed temperature. For example, as we increase the volume at a low temperature, we are for a while in the liquid state. As the volume increases, the pressure goes down, 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 until we hit a special point in which the liquid starts to boil. As the liquid starts to boil, it maintains the same pressure for a while, but the volume increases. Then the boiling ceases, and we are in the vapor phase. This is called the liquid-vapor phase transition. This occurs at a higher temperature also. Here's a higher temperature. The pressure decreases continuously as the volume increases. There is a jump in pressure between the two phases. You go from a liquid to a vapor. This continues up to a temperature called the critical temperature. The critical temperature, the critical pressure is 22.9 megapascals in water, and this diagram was copied out of a book which talked about water. The critical point of water occurs at 640 degrees, 47 degrees Kelvin. However, Andrew's work was with carbon dioxide, in which the critical pressure and critical temperature are much more accessible. I've forgotten precisely what they are. In any case, when you reach this critical point, the difference between the vapor phase, and the liquid phase has disappeared. You have a continuous behavior in which you go continuously through from one kind of fluid to another. Above the critical temperature, there's no distinction between liquid and vapor. You just have a simple continuous fall in pressure as you increase the volume of the system. Notice that there are two kinds of qualitative changes on this picture. One is the jump between the liquid and the vapor. That's a jump in which the density changes by a lot. And then the other kind of qualitative change is one, as one passes through this critical point, one goes from a situation where there is a jump to a situation there isn't, in which there isn't. These are both called phase transitions. This is called the first-order phase transition, jumping from one situation to another situation. This is called the continuous phase transition and is going to be discussed a lot in the next four lectures. Please, thank you.
Can you have a triple point occurring in a phase diagram with just solid phase transitions, like from, say, rhombohedral to cubic to tetragonal?
There are triple points in the phase diagrams. There are places in which three phases come together. I'm not looking at that at the moment, although I can find you a phase diagram. I'm not sure exactly what your question is, so I'll put up the diagram with the triple point. Let's do escape. Let's see what's under Windows. Open recent. Part 7, this is what's in your notes. Your notes certainly have a triple point, right? Beep, 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 beep. Here are your notes. There's a triple point. Okay, now, here's your triple point. What do you want to ask?
So, a triple point with the three phases in question are all solid.
Okay, no. There is a vapor, liquid, solid phase triple point in water at this pressure, which is in megapascals, 10 to the minus 3 megapascals, and a temperature of about 250, 270 degrees Kelvin.
So you can or can't have a triple
point? Here's a critical point. Okay. The diagram, the phase diagram for water looks like this. There are zillions of phases of ice, labeled 1 through 8. Ice 9 is a literary invention. There are phases of ice through here. Then there's a liquid phase, which occurs first at this pressure and goes through here. There's a vapor phase. In fact, one can make a distinction between them only on the phase transition line, since otherwise liquid and vapor are rather alike. This phase transition line ends at a critical point. Okay? Escape?
Sorry.
Yes, please.
I think Shane's question is, can you have, I think the answer is yes, you can have it, because you can see that there's three phases, three ice phases in contact.
You have three ice phases in contact.
So is that a triple point as well?
You can have four or five phases in contact.
So that's a triple point. We have three solid
phases.
Here's
a triple point with liquid, vapor, and solid. Here is a triple point with liquid and two different phases of solid.
And that one just below it is a triple point with three solid phases. And
there's one. There undoubtedly are going to be triple points with three solid phases.
Okay.
In fact, you could read all about this in J. Willard Gibbs's thermodynamics book, in which he invented what is called the phase rule, which tells you how many knobs you have to turn in order to get n phases in contact with one another. And that's one major starting point of modern thermodynamics. Escape. Back to the other lecture, although I won't be in the other lecture for long. Play. So here is the phase diagram that Andrew saw. There is more phase diagram for water with phases of ice out this way, which I'm not showing you. And just after Andrews did his experimental work and saw something like this, Johannes van der Waals derived an approximate equation of state for fluids. The equation of state had the form that many of you have studied in your previous statistical mechanics courses. Here it is. He started out from the equation of state for a perfect non-interacting gas, which we derived, which is P, with the V, equals N, the number of particles in the system, times the Boltzmann constant, times the temperature. He then said, let's modify this equation of state to include the effect of interactions among the particles. The first and most simple-minded interaction that he took into account was the fact that each particle had a little volume around it that other particles couldn't enter. The total excluded volume, excluded because of that, is n, number of particles, times the volume excluded by each particle, called here b. And so that was the first change in the PV's NKT of phase equation of state that van der Waals derived for us. The second change was, he said, that there was an attractive long-range potential between the molecules, and that that would produce an attraction which would then appear as a term in which some constant, which was sort of the integral of the potential of interaction between the particles, times the density squared, number of particles per unit volume squared. His basic argument was that there was a dimensional, was a dimensional argument, that if you have interaction between particles, which is some potential, which depends on Rj minus Rk, where Rj and Rk are the position of the jth and kth molecule, then that will produce a change in the pressure which is proportional to the density squared. There's a constant of proportionality. He said that the interaction was mostly attractive. The reason he said the interaction was mostly attractive is that if I, the surface tension of liquids, if I take a drop of liquid and put it on the window pane, it stays a drop. There's a attractive force keep holding the liquid in place. That's what this says. And so he wrote down this cubic, because it has a factor of, it has terms up to v cubed in it. If you multiply through by v squared, you have up to terms up to v cubed in it. This is a cubic equation of state, and that equation of state was what he said would describe the fluid. Here's a picture of van der Waals' equation of state, once again with pressure versus volume, once again with isotherms, that is, lines of constant temperature. You notice that this is different from the last picture I showed you of that kind. For one thing, it does not have any jump between the different phases. It has a maximum here, which is sort of like a maximum that occurs in Andrew's picture, but the jump between a liquid and a gas phase simply does not occur, and there are no singularities anyplace in the van der Waals discussion. This is unsuitable. It's wrong. It's bad. There is water does boil. You do go from a liquid to a gas, and you have to fix up the van der Waals equation in order to make it right. This somewhat incorrect equation is our first example of a mean field theory. We'll have other examples. But the mean field theory was then almost immediately fixed up by Maxwell. Says what I already said, that there's no reference to the infinite size of the system. There are no singularities and no phase transitions in this picture. Phase transitions and singularities were added by theoretical work of Maxwell. Maxwell pointed out that a situation in which the pressure goes up as the volume increases is unstable. It's mechanically unstable, and the system simply won't do that. He then went on to talk about mechanical and thermodynamic stability, and Maxwell said that all of the stuff here was going to be mechanically unstable and had a slightly larger region of thermodynamic instability, and analyzed the thermodynamics to say that there would be jumps between a liquid and a gaseous state, and that these jumps between liquid and gas were necessary for thermodynamic reasons. So here is a cartoon, that is a sketch diagram, for phase transitions for water as Maxwell fixed it up for van der Waals. You may notice the continuity in science. We publish in Nature to this day, and this appeared in Nature in 1874. This theory, as put together by Maxwell and van der Waals, was then applied to ferromagnetic systems by Pierre Curie and Pierre Weiss. Pierre Curie, as I probably don't have to tell you, is the somewhat less famous husband of a more famous scientist. Pierre Curie said that the van der Waals theory would apply to ferromagnets, and Pierre Weiss put it all together and produced a theory which did apply to the ferromagnetic transition. I'm about to talk about that. I'm going to try switching to the other talk that I actually prepared for you and is actually in your notes, but it's a good place to ask about whether there are any questions. I've now taken you through the theory of phase transitions, sort of up to the year 1875, or maybe 1907, if you want to say that. Okay, so escape. Here we are back in the old talk, back in your lecture notes. Gibbs said a phase transition is a sharp change in thermodynamic behavior. Here is the here's a phase diagram for a magnetic system. One reason for talking about the magnetic system is that the phase diagram for the magnetic system is simpler than the phase diagram for the fluid system. Here's a plot, magnetic field going up, temperature going that way, and what happens is that as we apply at low temperatures, as we apply a magnetic field, there is a jump in the magnetization of the magnet. The magnetization points in the same direction as the magnetic field always. It reaches some finite value here and then jumps to some finite value in the opposite direction there. This jump is a large jump at low temperatures. It gets smaller and smaller as the temperature increases until at some special critical point, the jump goes to zero. Near the critical point, the jump goes as the temperature minus the critical temperature to some power, and that power is, in the theory that I'm going to be talking about, 1/2, and that's going to be an important result. So here's the conceptually the simplest phase transition. And now I'm going to tell you in the next few minutes how one derives a mean field theory for this phase transition in the very simplest form. We've already talked about the very simplest model for this, which is the Ising model. I don't have to go over and tell you again what the Ising model is. I will, to some extent, do that, however, and then tell you how we get a mean field theory for the Ising model. So the Ising model has a Hamiltonian, which minus the Hamiltonian divided by kT is some coupling constant, dimensionless, times the sum over nearest neighbors times spin variables at those nearest neighbors. these spin variables take on the value plus or minus 1, indicating a local magnetization that points in this direction or that direction. There's also a magnetic field proportional to H, and then a term in the Hamiltonian of magnetic field times the spin at point R. The free energy is, as we know, given by the logarithm of a sum over all possibilities of the exponential of the Hamiltonian divided by K and KT. We're going to be talking a lot about the average magnetization, which depends on the coupling constant in H. Even when there is no magnetic field applied, if there is a strong coupling, the spins can line up and the magnetization can be non-zero. We're going to look at the Ising model to see the nature of mean field theory for this case. We started the course by talking about what happens when you have one spin and the Hamiltonian. Excuse me?
During today's tutorial, the students will derive this equation, that the average of sigma is equal to, yes.
Okay, so I don't have to tell you about it. You've all done it, each and every one of you. The average magnetization in the presence of a magnetic field is going to be equal to the hyperbolic tangent of the dimensionless version of that magnetic field. Now, that's a moderately interesting result, but doesn't tell us anything about a phase transition. However, Pierre Weiss said, let's look at the Hamiltonian and try to figure out what's going on. Let's try to see whether we can use the Hamiltonian to make a good guess for what you might get in the presence of the interaction among spins. In fact, let's focus our attention on one spin, the guy at R. The guy at R has interacts with the nearest neighbors, that are S around it, and interacts with the magnetic field itself. In fact, the two interaction terms appear as sum. The magnetic field at R appears as H at R. And then there's a coupling constant, the sum over S times the magnetization at S. However, that's not exactly what this equation says. This equation puts an average around the magnetization at S. What Weiss said was, let's imagine that there is an effective magnetic field on the spin at R, which is the honest-to-goodness magnetic field, plus the field produced by the neighbors. There are Z neighbors, hence this sum goes over Z terms. If nothing depends on space, you get coupling constant times Z times the magnitude of the spin, and you make a theory then in which things behave exactly like free particles, except that the free particles are moving in the average field produced by all of the neighboring particles. This is what is called a mean field theory, and this is the theory that we are going to use to describe what happens in the phase transition. If there's variation in space, the effective field at R is the honest-to-goodness field at R plus K times the sum over all nearest neighbors to R times the average spin at the nearest neighbors. We're going to focus on these equations. This is an approximation called mean field theory. We'd like to understand the qualitative structure of the phase diagram for the Ising model by looking at the mean field theory results. I emphasize once again that this is as distinct from the stuff that I did up until here. This is all in the notes, precisely in the form that I'm giving it to you. Okay, let's imagine that K is a large positive number and try to figure out what will happen. Yes?
Treat it as like a fluid movement with particles on a constant magnetic field.
I'm trying to understand the question, but let me describe it to you this way. Take a hunk of iron or nickel or some ferromagnetic material. It has a lattice. The lattice doesn't exactly look like this. Not really a simple cubic lattice, but it has a lattice. And each lattice site has some spin on it. And the spin can point in one of a whole bunch of directions. It's a quantum mechanical spin. Iron and nickel both have spin 1/2, if I remember correctly. There are what are called easy axes in both of these materials. That is, the spin finds it easy to point this way, easy to point that way, hard to point at a 45-degree angle to the crystal axes. We will then approximate what we see, by not using the 8 directions of easiness, but 2 directions of easiness. That is, we will say that each and every spin can point in one of 2 directions, and then we represent the problem by the Isaac model, which is the model that our friend Isaac developed in conjunction with his thesis advisor Lenz to describe the situation. It is a heavily oversimplified model. It is a model for guys who sit on a lattice, as distinct from guys who can swim through all space like in a liquid, but it is a model which we can treat reasonably simply. Did I answer your question?
No, it just seems that you, after you have the effective magnetic field, you treat them as though they're free particles moving in this effective magnetic field.
Right.
Do you forget about the lattice?
Not exactly. We're going to...
I mean, like you need some kind of... Like you need the spacing to remain the same.
We'll keep the spacing the same. We'll imagine that each and every spin has a position. However, if the magnetic field does not depend on R, as in this equation, then the magnetization doesn't depend on R either. And so all of the magnetizations at all of these different positions are the same. That is, instead of having the actual direction of the spin, we're going to replace this by an average sigma, which is smaller than the actual sigma, but all the same at every point in space. Now this is a big, as you point out, this is a big change, a nasty approximation. However, this will give us replacing this honest material by this dishonest description will give us a qualitative understanding of what happens in the phase transition. It will give us a phase diagram which looks very much like that. It will give us a jump between the magnetization up and the magnetization down, which looks very much like the jump that occurs in iron, at least qualitatively. The goal of all of these guys is to get a qualitative description of the phase transition. Now, you may argue, perhaps, that there are all kinds of things which we are doing, which is sort of wicked. We've replaced a spin, which is this long, by an average, which is that long. we have replaced a situation in which fluctuations occur by situation in which they're only averages. That's true. And it is far from wonderful. However, to this day, no one has a much better theory in three dimensions than the theory I'm going to tell you about, somewhat better. But there will be quantitative errors in any theory that you look at of ferromagnetism. No theory is going to give you quantitatively correct results for iron or nickel. I'm not sure whether I've answered your question now. Next time, we will pick up on this equation, which gives the average magnetization as a function of the magnetic field and as an implicit function of the average magnetization. That is, this is a nonlinear equation for the average magnetization. We will look at the particular case in which the average magnetization is small and find, somewhat to our surprise, that the structure of the equation is the same as the structure of the equation that van der Waals derived for the liquid. We will then go on to calculate the properties of the thing, first far away from the critical point and then close to the critical point. We'll then come back to worrying about whether or not mean field theories are accurate. The short answer to whether mean field theories are accurate is that they're accurate enough to get qualitative and interesting pictures of what happens far from the critical point, but they're not accurate enough to get a qualitatively correct picture of what happens near the critical point. We'll then develop the renormalization group theory as a description of what might be happening near the critical point and see that that gives us a much more accurate description. So my apologies for deviating from the notes. I'll be back on the notes for a while talking about mean field theory, and then I'll deviate again. Dennis, we have been asked to make sure that part six gets put up. Part six hasn't changed any from last year, so we just have to look up last year's thing. I can give you a slightly improved version, but why don't you put up the part six from last year, and then I'll try to remember to give you the slightly improved version. Questions or comments? It's lunchtime.